Hi, and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, back here at disasterpodcast.com. And I'm really looking forward to having our special guest back with us again tonight. We have Wendy Hess that will be joining us later on here in the show in just a few minutes to chat with us a little bit more about how you might be able to get started in doing something like what she does in El Salvador, helping give medical support and provide medical care to a community in need. Before we get to all that, though, and chat with Wendy, I want to always recognize my esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
I'm great, and I'm feeling very fortunate to be in this country where there's not quite so many bats and bugs and other things that Wendy was telling us about last time. I didn't understand austere medicine as well as I do now. But we're not alone tonight. We have Dr. Joe with us and Jim. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. Glad to be here again.
Jim, you there? Jim?
Oh, yes, I'm here. Yeah, that's great. I was just thinking about an old Jim Stanford song. I don't like spiders and snakes. And podcast kind of brought that home.
Yeah, I think so. I heard beer. About spiders the size of my hand, and I just kind of freaked out. And I work in a basement studio, and I kind of look around for the little tiny spiders we have here in Maryland, but I don't know what I'd do.
Exactly. Well, we're going to talk about something else.
Yep.
Great to be here.
So, Wendy, we'd like to welcome you back to the show. We had such a great time chatting with you last time about the work you've done in El Salvador, the amazing work under some pretty severe conditions to provide medical care to a community in need there. And while we were talking about that, it kind of came up that we'd like to chat with you this time about how you got started doing that and how someone else can kind of get hooked up with an organization and find themselves in that situation and prepare themselves for that kind of work.
Hi. Thank you for welcoming me back, first of all. And I really wasn't, when I first started this thing, I wasn't really prepared for what I went up against. But I wasn't alone. So the organization that I went with is through some Lutheran and Presbyterian church here in the Bay Area in Santa Cruz and over in. I have a cat in the background. I'm sorry. I have to get rid of him. Hold on a second.
That's all right. That's how you keep the spiders down. I know. That's.
I think. Okay.
Okay. So the way we did is we went. I was with the organization SantaCruzElSalvador.org. They've been going to this community for 20 years now. There are other organizations in California and through the Presbyterian and Lutheran churches that do support these types of trips, and they go over there on a regular basis. They provide water systems for communities in need, plumbing, toilet, composting toilet systems for communities in need. And there's just so many organizations that I don't have the names of them off the top of my head, but the one that I go with, like I said, has been doing this for 20 years. And what they do is they take a congregation from different people from different congregations, and they take a delegation of about 20 to 25 people over there, consisting of doctors, nurses, different folks that are involved in working with the community on a personal level, and they form relationships with these people, and they go and work with all the different agencies in El Salvador, the health agency over there, and some of the food agencies. There's a food agency called Joining Hands Against Hunger. A woman named Christy Van Nostrand works with that organization. It's Presbyterian run, and they work to help people farm food to have their own seeds, their own original seeds, and farm their own food instead of depending on places like Monsanto and have them be self-sustaining. So we work with people like that. A lot of the bishops from the Lutheran churches over there, we work with communities leaders, and we also stay with some of the assemblymen over there and work with several assemblymen to try to get more support. And also, this helps us, also some mayors of some of the cities that we visit, but this helps us get supplies through customs when we come. So that's what I wanted to mention was when we come, we bring lots and lots of supplies from the States, from MedShare and other organizations that donate. And then we go to customs and we have letters that have been written. They expect us. They know we're coming. We bring different kinds of medicines and hard medical supplies, hard medical equipment, things that normally wouldn't get through somehow magically make it through because we formed all these relationships ahead of time. There's also a man named Les Gardner. I don't know if anybody knows who he is, but he's responsible for creating a lot of these relationships ahead of time and getting sort of smoothing the way for our organizations and others like us to get involved into these communities and be able to assist people. But there's a lot of little ins and outs to getting things like lidocaine through. They don't like us to bring any kind of class 2 drugs or especially lidocaine through without special special letters and handling. It's definitely tricky. It gets very tricky.
Wendy,
so we found that out a couple times. Go ahead.
Wendy, this is Joe. Could you tell us a little bit about sort of what you personally had to do in order for you to be ready to go? Obviously, things like vaccinations, et cetera. But were there other things? I mean, as far as educating yourself on the culture there, other supplies that you needed to take personally, or special things you needed to do before you were allowed to be deployed there?
Yes. This organization's very, very, very tight about doing several meetings in preparation for the delegation's visits. Twice a year now we do this, where we have a whole trip guidelines that we go through and we sit down with people and we have these long lists of the rules and regulations of being in a third world country, specifically there, and what you need to prepare. We have long lists of supplies you need to bring, the vaccinations that you need, lots of sunscreen, all the food and water precautions, hand washing, safety, a lot of personal and hygiene supplies that you need to have with you since they don't have them there, that we need to know about all your chronic illnesses or allergies or anything, prescriptions that you're taking. So we have also a built-in insurance plan so that everybody that's going has insurance in case something should happen. And they, you know, you can go to a hospital there and they'll take care of you, but there's a lot of prep that goes into educating everybody, including myself, before you even step on the plane. There's months and months of talking about what to, like we said earlier, what to expect. And every night we have when we're in the country, every night we have a debriefing and we talk about the day. We talk about the good things that happened. We talked about the things that could have been dangerous. We talk about how people are feeling. We check everyone over to make sure that they're healthy. The nurses go around and check on people. We've had several sicknesses over the years where we've taken care of some of our own while we're working, you know, in the community and in the clinic. So people do get sick there. And so it's just about communication and stewardship and really just knowing that you're going to a very unsafe place and that and what to expect, the rough terrain, the weather, the things that you're going to that you're not used to the comforts of home. Like I said before, it's very much like extreme camping and extreme camping. So some people are prepared, and if they're not, they certainly find out as soon as they get there how astute you need to be on a daily basis, especially safety wise, staying together, never going outside of the group without having a buddy. So we practice the buddy system. You don't go anywhere alone, especially at night in the community. We always stay together in groups, and you always report any suspicious activity or anything like that. Because as I said, there's a lot of violence there mostly against the community and the people that amongst themselves, but they could also at any time decide, you know, that they could harm us. So there's always that possibility, but there's a lot of prep that goes into, and making sure that you're healthy before you leave. If you come there sick, then it's just not good. So some people cancel out at the last minute because they've gotten ill before the trip. So it's really important to be healthy before you go over there, because you're going to be exposed. So spiritually,
we've talked about that as well. I know Joe in the past, Jim, we've talked about the need for teams before they deploy to assess their own health and make the decision not to go. Should they have some kind of bug that could get spread around to the rest of the group?
I think that's what happened last year to one of the delegations that went that I wasn't on, but someone had come with the rotavirus, got on the plane, they were in the delegation, they quickly spread it to the rest of the team, and rotavirus went around to about 20 people and just about wiped them out halfway through their delegation trip. And the delegations run about 10 to 12 days. So it can really put a damper in the whole spirit of the thing if you have something like that. So we really try to be careful. They practice a lot, and I stress this, hand washing with soap and water if you can get it. Really just a lot of that hand washing helps a lot. So that's just a little bit about what we do to prepare and also to get through customs. The customs is very nerve-wracking. In every way. So going there and coming back, they take everything out of your bag. They look at everything. So it's something to be aware of. Be careful what you bring, and make sure you only bring the things that are on the list. Don't bring any surprises. We don't like surprises. So any other questions?
I think you had a question earlier that you didn't answer.
Cultural education. Yes. I'm sorry. Really quickly. You don't have to speak Spanish to go to a country in Central America, but it helps. But it does help to know what you do and don't do in terms of the culture, in terms of addressing people, in terms of knowing what, like I said earlier, that the men are sort of the hierarchical leaders and they're the ones you address first. And that the women are more in the kitchen and worried about the cooking and the children. And it's very hierarchical there. And it's good to, there isn't film out about El Salvador, about the war in El Salvador. And also it's good to know a little bit about the history of how El Salvador, what they've gone through in the past, and a little bit about, well, a lot about how to respect their culture when you're there, and that you basically are guests in their country. And so that's how you treat them, that they're your hosts and you're the guest, and they treat you very, very much as the guest of honor, and they give everything they can to you. But at the same time, it's important to understand that they've been through a lot and that they deserve, you know, respect and dignity. And that's, it's like having a relationship with somebody. You go there intending to form a bond and to have a relationship. And it's good to know the history. The thing that we do for new members when we take them is they spend a day at the museum in San Salvador that talks about the history of El Salvador and what's gone on there in the past, and talks about their culture, and we take them to different places where they can learn about the culture of El Salvador, so that they have an idea of what the country's been through, and they have more of a deeper understanding of why people are so passionate about their lives there, because that country is so packed with people. There's more people per capita in that small little country than you could imagine. There's people everywhere, and there's not enough room for all the people. So they all have to get along, and it's amazing that they do. But at one time they didn't, as you know, with the Civil War. So we try to educate people about that before they come, or as soon as they get there, they get a taste of what it was really like. And we also talk about the danger of why people walk around with, not people, but why there's guards everywhere guarding everything from banks to ice cream stores to pizza parlors. There's a guard at every door just about in El Salvador, in the city itself, and also in the country, in front of the stores. Anywhere there's money, there's a guard with guns. So that's a shock to some people. They're not used to it. They don't get it, and we have to explain ahead of time, you're going to see this, and here's why. Here's why we stress sticking together and being respectful. So,
Wendy, one thing I was impressed with, you know, you're talking about the education of your team, you know, going into that environment, but one of the things you touched on that I'd love to hear more about is the education you do within that community. Because you brought up a whole lot of things that were just not good that with a little bit of education could really be improved. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Jim, you are...
Mainly our goal there isn't to perform miracles or to think that we're going to see several thousand people and make it a huge difference in the health of their the day. But what we do catch is a lot of diseases that are very prevalent, like I was saying earlier, diabetes, and some of these skin diseases, some of the GI disorders that are because of the foul water, standing water for the mosquitoes and the dengue fever. We do a lot of education for the sexually transmitted diseases and birth control. And I think I named diabetes, dengue fever, sugar intake, toothbrushing, mouth care and toothbrushing, especially for the children, is a big topic of education for them. And we bring pamphlets in Spanish. They also provide us with some of their material that we're able to pass out and reinforce. And what we do is we get groups of kids together while their mom's in line, getting her blood pressure checked and getting her weight and getting, you know, some aspirin for her headaches or whatnot. We take the kids and we teach them all about toothbrushing and mosquitoes and water and hand washing and staying away from sugar products and trying to make it fun for them. And one year I actually taught a basic CPR course for some people in Spanish, what to do when you find somebody down or if somebody collapses, how you assess and just basic CPR. It was really interesting. They had a tape for me. It was all in Spanish. It was really interesting how many people were involved and excited about learning about it. So there, people are very curious and very willing to learn, but a lot of education happens there because that's really all we can leave them with. You know, you understand we're only there for a week and they're there the rest of the year. So you get a lot done in a short amount of time.
Well, that brings up a question for me, being a pre-hospital type, as Jim is. Is there any kind of pre-hospital care providers? You mentioned earlier an ambulance that comes and goes through the local hospital and local clinic, but not much outside of that. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of somebody did go, would there be someone to come and get them and someplace to take them? I don't have a good sense of that.
There really isn't someone. It's a half an hour to the hospital. There's no pre-hospital care. What they have is these nurses called promotoras, and they go around to the communities, and they have their finger on the pulse of the health. They have records of everybody, every single person, and it's a requirement because that's their job. So they know who's healthy and who's not, who's had a recent surgery. They go follow up on people who've been to the hospital. They go follow up on their diabetics, and they follow up on their childhood diseases. And they basically walk around every day, miles and miles all over those hills, and check on their patients. But if someone was to code, they have a lot of their culture is also very spiritual, and they feel, some of them feel that they're, that's a sign from God, and that there's not much they can do. So if someone's going to have a code out there, the chances of getting to a defib machine or getting to a hospital before the major damage is done is pretty slim to none. So I don't know what happens to some of those people, but as I said, we had a woman come to our clinic that was having an active MI, and we got her to the hospital, but that's very rare that we catch that when we're there. That's something that they go to the doctor for because they've been having chest pain and it's not their usual heartburn, and maybe they're a little sweaty, a little nauseated. And the doctor makes a determination there at the clinic, you know, you need to go to Suchitoto and see the big doctors and, you know, go and get checked out. So that's really how it goes. They try to get into the clinic, which is only open 2 days a week. So 2 days a week, they might have to walk 10 miles to this clinic to see the doctor. That's how remote it is.
Yeah, it is. But that kind of brings up the next question, because you talked about identifying diabetics and asthmatics and people that clearly need some longer-term care. Is that care available to them? Are those meds available to them? Is there refrigeration for, you know, insulin? What kind of provisions are made for those people after you leave, or are there any?
There aren't any refrigerators in these mountains. Usually, if someone has money, they'll have a refrigerator, but it might be the only refrigerator in a community of 600 or 700 people. So insulin is a big deal. If you need insulin, there's things that the health organization in El Salvador can provide for you, but you go to the hospital, you get on an insulin regimen. They figure it out. They figure out how to do their meds, and some of the insulin that they have access to doesn't need to be refrigerated. They have these new pens now that are very slick, and they just have to keep them in a cool, dry place. And there's a lot of cool, dry places where they live because they dig their houses into dirt. So all of the floors in these places is either dirt or tile. And they figure it out. I think that for the people that have to manage those kind of diseases, which is on the rise, I think they're getting more and more savvy about how to manage that, how to send people home with the right instructions and the right tools to make sure that they can keep themselves tested and keep themselves healthy. But the children are getting diabetes because some of them are getting overweight because there's so much sugar available to them. So it's a big, big problem. It's one of the bigger problems they have. So,
Dr. Joe, I know you have to have some questions burning. You've been too quiet back here.
I've just been talking again. Here we go.
And that's okay because we're all fascinated.
Well, you're right, and you were kind of touching on it already there, Sam, as far as just kind of the pre-hospital world. Obviously, that's where my passion lies. And so it is fascinating to sort of hear about the complete absence of that system altogether. Is there any sort of system like that in the larger cities there? Is there a 911 system? Is there any of those kind of things in place at all, Wendy?
Oh, absolutely. They have a very, very slick hospital system in El Salvador. It works very well. There's several clinics and hospitals in El Salvador that are very busy, and they have all the latest state-of-the-art equipment. There's a lot of money that gets poured into that. And if you have a big problem that one of the smaller community hospitals cannot address, they ship you to El Salvador and they treat you there. And they have housing where people can stay while they're being treated. So there's a lot of the health organization over there. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It's huge and it's very well funded. And the problem with it is, though, that it's all going into El Salvador, and there's these outlying communities of people that are miles and hundreds of miles away from the big city that don't have access to these services. So most of the women who are having children out there are having them with midwives. So if there is a complication, for instance, with a woman giving birth, it's the midwife who's first on scene, and that's scary. And there's 5,000 babies being born a day in some parts of that country. So there's a lot of midwives and there's a lot of babies. It's amazing how many children get born in El Salvador in a week. So there's a huge organization that trains midwives, and they're all stationed in all parts of the outlying parts of the country. And that's how they handle that. And if there are complications, again, they have to transport them to the bigger hospitals. But they are state-of-the-art, and they are very nice. They are well-run. The hospital that I visit in Suchitoto is a community small hospital, and I kid you not, it's like walking into the 50s. The colors, everything, all their equipment, their beds, everything is like from circa 1950. It's amazing. I have pictures if you ever want to see them. It's like stepping back in time.
So, Joe, it sounds like Paragon maybe needs to do a course in international response. There's a lot of things I'm learning today. Just the general idea that people going into other countries like this. I mean, obviously, every country is different, but there's some general things that, first of all, it's not like it is here. It's very different, and be aware of that.
Well, you're right, Sam, and, you know, we've talked in the past about some international deployment. And the challenges associated with that, you know, I think the cultural aspect of that and just the significantly different way of doing things than what we're used to is a huge challenge for responders going into those situations and can easily cause as much problem as they are there to try to solve by putting themselves into position that they don't need to be in from a cultural standpoint.
That's the point you made about cultural, is that we don't go in there and look at their clinic and say, oh my gosh, we've got to change all this cabinetry, which isn't really cabinetry, or we've got to move this this medicine to the other side because it's too close to this medicine, or all your stuff is out of date. We don't go in and try to change anything about what they're doing because that's what they've always done. We just work with them and we just supplement their supply. We don't go in there and tell them what to do. We just go in there and we say, here's some more supplies. What do you need? What can we bring next time? And we're really happy that you're able to help the people in the community. How can we help you do it better? But we don't ever step on anybody's toes. It's a very special dance that we do with our relationships with the medical people there, because they're under such duress and there's so many, they get so much trauma in their ER, but they do such a fantastic job handling it with so very little. I mean, they have so very little, but they do such a great job. It's amazing. I'm impressed by what they do, and they're really humble, beautiful people. And it's, that's why I keep going back. I've caught whatever virus that you get when you go there, and I just have to keep going back. So
I have to jump in on that, because, you know, we've talked a little bit about a trip I took to Ukraine, and I learned the very same thing. Even though they don't have a lot, they're very resourceful about utilizing what they do have. And I think we're probably going to wrap up here pretty soon, but that's a good place to end. Is just like we tried to explain, and it's so hard to do with USAR, with DMAT, with the federal teams and the NGOs that you're talking about. What is it that drives us? What is it that keeps us going back? Is it the people? Is it that sense of knowing you've really made a difference? And you're saying the big picture, maybe not, but that little kid that no longer has a toothache because somebody took care of that for them, or somebody who can manage their diabetes a little better or their asthma. How would you explain that, Wendy?
I think it's, you just said it. I think all you get, if you get one little smile and one little flower that they've brought you, or you get some family member that's spent their last $2 on a gift for you and said, thank you, please come back, we want to see you again, that makes it all worthwhile. And you just can't get that anywhere else. You can't get that kind of respect and love from just anybody. It has to come from mutual respect and admiration. And I think that's what we form there, is these, we form relationships. That's what we do. We don't go there to fix anybody. We go there to form relationships so that we can keep coming back and being of service. It's a church driven NGO, and there are lots of NGOs, but some of the biggest ones are run by Presbyterian and Lutheran churches. They are the most prevalent in that country, and hundreds of people and thousands of people from churches all over the world, Presbyterian, Lutheran, go there every year to do just that, to be of service. So I know there's Doctors Without Borders, there's lots of other organizations which I haven't been a part of, but the one that I'm a part of now, I'd have to say makes it worthwhile. And the children are really grateful, and that you get to see them grow up, and it's just amazing. Some of them are surgeons now. Some of them are practicing surgeons. That's what the money has done that we've been giving to their community over the years. It's put them through school. So it makes a big difference to see a child thrive like that. I mean, it's worth it. Even one child.
It's so important.
And that's amazing. I had no idea they'd been doing it for this many years. But it really says a lot about you and your husband and all those people that are taking their time away from their own families and their jobs and everything else to be of service. So you should be commended for what it is you do. And I'm throwing this back to Jamie because I know he's sitting out there going, you know, we've got to wrap this up.
Yeah, we do need to wrap it up, and I know people have got to get off the line here. So, Wendy, we have your contact information for you and your organization. We'll make sure we have that in the show notes so people can head over to disasterpodcast.com and check that out. Joe, where can folks find Paragon?
Well, Paragon is on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and on Facebook and Twitter at ParagonMedEDU.
Yep, and we will really appreciate your continued support of the Disaster Podcast and allowing us to bring special guests like Wendy here on the show to talk about her experiences with dealing with austere environments and medical care. And it's been important to continue to bring this discussion. And Wendy, you're invited back anytime if you want to come and join us and chat about whatever our topic of the week is. We'd love to have you.
Thank you so much. I'll try not to be so long-winded. I just get going and I can't stop. Sam knows.
Thanks, Randy. We really enjoyed having you on again.
Great. Sam, where can folks find you?
It's the usual.
No, that's all right. Go ahead, Jim.
You can find, Dr. Hollick said, just reach out to us on those social media sites, and we'll get back to you. And it's just been a pleasure and very, very interesting listening to Wendy and her experiences, and it's a different type of medicine, but there are so many similarities, so many, and I'm going to enjoy listening to her talk about her experiences with her DMAP team as she grows into that as well.
Definitely. So, Sam, as we wrap up here, why don't we just finalize where can folks find you and the show and everything else?
Yeah, I have to agree with Jim. I learned a lot from this discussion. Made me appreciate – I know if we deploy, I want to be with her because anything else for her is going to be easy. But where do you find me? The usual social media places under Sam Bradley. Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. And Jamie, where do they find you?
Well, you can find me and under the handle PodMedic just about everywhere. Of course, all of my shows are available over at MedicCast.com, including the Disaster Podcast. But you want to find this show in its own home, and that's at DisasterPodcast.com, where we bring out a new show for you every single Thursday to talk about dealing with interesting and austere environments and medical care and unusual situations. Yeah, we talk about disasters and hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes and things like that, but we're going to bring you a lot of looks at different ways that people are serving their communities and the world community in many different ways in future episodes, so stay tuned for that. Sam, we're done here for this episode. Why don't you close us out?
Yeah, and I just as a parting note, I'd like to say I was fascinated by this. I'll be absorbing this information for a while, and hopefully if you guys enjoy this just as much, please throw up your questions. I'm sure Wendy would love to answer them for you and maybe give us some fodder for some further podcasts with her and on this subject. So please come to the website and do that. In the meantime, consider that disaster medicine is not everyday medicine.